Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the July 8th edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is What Happens After AI Destroys College Writing by Hua Su. Annals of Education, What Happens After AI Destroys College Writing. The demise of the English paper will end a long intellectual tradition, but it's also an opportunity to re-examine the purpose of higher education, by Hua Su. On a blustery spring Thursday just after midterms, I went out for noodles with Alex and Eugene, two undergraduates at New York University, to talk about how they use artificial intelligence in their schoolwork. When I first met Alex last year, he was interested in a career in the arts, and he devoted a lot of his free time to photo shoots with his friends. But he had recently decided on a more practical path. He wanted to become a CPA. His Thursdays were busy, and he had 45 minutes until a study session for an accounting class. He stowed his skateboard under a bench in the restaurant and shook his laptop out of his bag, connecting to the internet before we sat down. Alex has wavy hair and speaks with the chill, sing-song cadence of someone who has spent a lot of time in the Bay Area. He and Eugene scanned the menu, and Alex said that they should get clear broth rather than spicy so we can both lock in our skincare. Weeks earlier, when I'd messaged Alex, he had said that everyone he knew used ChatGPT in some fashion, but that he used it only for organizing his notes. In person, he admitted that this wasn't remotely accurate. "Any type of writing in life, I use AI," he said. He replied on Claude for research, DeepSeek for reasoning and explanation, and Gemini for image generation. ChatGPT served more general needs. "I need AI to text girls," he joked, imagining an AI-enhanced version of Hinge. I asked if he had used AI when setting up our meeting. He laughed and then replied, "Honestly, yeah. I'm not trying to type all that. Could you tell? AI released ChatGPT on November 30, 2022. 6 days later, Sam Altman, the CEO, announced that it had reached 1 million users. Large language models like ChatGPT don't think in the human sense. When you ask ChatGPT a question, it draws from the data sets it has been trained on and builds an answer based on predictable word patterns. Companies had experimented with AI-driven chatbots for years, but most sputtered upon release. Microsoft's 2016 experiment with a bot named Tay was shut down after 16 hours because it began spouting racist rhetoric and denying the Holocaust. But ChatGPT seemed different. It could hold a conversation and break complex ideas down into easy-to-follow steps. Within a month, Google's management, fearful that AI would have an impact to its search engine business, declared a code red. Among educators, an even greater panic arose. It was too deep into the school term to implement a coherent policy for what seemed like a homework killer. In seconds, ChatGPT could collect and summarize research and draft a full essay. Many large campuses tried to regulate ChatGPT and its eventual competitors, mostly in vain. I asked Alex to show me an example of an AI-produced paper. Eugene wanted to see it, too. He used a different AI app to help with computations for his business classes, but he had never gotten the hang of using it for writing. "I got you," Alex told him. "All the students I spoke with are identified by pseudonyms." He opened Claude on his laptop. I noticed a chat that mentioned abolition. "We had to read Robert Wedderburn for a class," he explained, referring to a 19th century Jamaican abolitionist. "But obviously I wasn't trying to read that." He had prompted Claude for a summary, but it was too long for him to read in the 10 minutes he had before class started. "He told me," I said, "turn it into concise bullet points." He then transcribed Claude's points in his notebook since his professor ran a screen-free classroom. Alex searched until he found a paper for an art history class about a museum exhibition. He had gone to the show, taken photographs of the images and the accompanying wall text, and then uploaded them to Claude, asking it to generate a paper according to the professor's instructions. "I'm trying to do the least work possible because this is a class I'm not hella fucking with," he said. After skimming the essay, he felt that the AI hadn't sufficiently addressed the professor's questions, so he refined the prompt and told it to try again. In the end, Alex's submission received the equivalent of an A-. He said that he had a basic grasp of the paper's argument, but that if the professor had asked him for specifics, he'd have been so fucked. I read the paper over Alex's shoulder. It was a solid imitation of how an undergraduate might describe a set of images. If this had been 2007, I wouldn't have made much of its generic tone, or of the precise box-ticking quality of its critical observations. Eugene, serious and somewhat solemn, had been listening with amusement. I would not cut and paste like he did, because I'm a lot more paranoid, he said. He's a couple of years younger than Alex and was in high school when ChatGPT was released. At the time, he experimented with the AI for essays but noticed that it made easily noticed errors. This passed the AI detector, he asked Alex. When ChatGPT launched, instructors adopted various measures to ensure that students' work was their own. These included requiring them to share timestamp version histories of their Google documents and designing writing assignments that had been completed in person over multiple sessions. But most detective work occurs after submission. Services like GPT-0, CopyLeaks, and Originality AI analyze the structure and syntax of a piece of writing and assess the likelihood that it was produced by a machine. Alex said that his art history professor was hella old and therefore probably didn't know about such programs. We fed the paper into a few different AI detection websites. One said there was a 28% chance that the paper was AI generated. Another put the odds at 61%. That's better than I expected, Eugene said. I asked if he thought what his friend had done was cheating, and Alex interrupted. Of course. Are you fucking kidding me? As we looked at Alex's laptop, I noticed that he had recently asked ChatGPT whether it was okay to go running in Nike Dunks. He had concluded that ChatGPT made for the best confidant. He consulted it as one might a therapist, asking for tips on dating and how to stay motivated during dark times. His ChatGPT sidebar was an index of the highs and lows of being a young person. He admitted to me and Eugene that he'd used ChatGPT to draft his application to NYU. Our lunch might never happen had it not been for AI. I guess it's really dishonest, but fuck it, I'm here, he said. It's cheating, but I don't think it's like cheating, Eugene said. He saw Alex's art history essay as a victimless crime. He was just fulfilling requirements, not training to become a literary scholar. Alex had to rush off to his study session. I told Eugene that our conversation made me wonder about my function as a professor. He asked if I taught English, and I nodded. Okay, he said, and laughed. So you're, like, majorly affected. I teach at a small liberal arts college, and I often joke that a student is more likely to hand in a big paper a year late, as recently happened, than to make a dishonorable shortcut. My classes are small and intimate, driven by processes and pedagogical modes, like letting awkward silences linger, that are difficult to scale. As a result, I have always had a vague sense that my students are learning something, even when it is hard to quantify. In the past, if I was worried that a paper had been plagiarized, I would enter a few phrases from it into a search engine and call it due diligence. But I recently began noticing that some students' writing seemed out of sync with how they expressed themselves in the classroom. One essay felt stitched together from two minds. Half of it was polished and rote, the other intimate and unfiltered. Having never articulated a policy for AI, I took the easy way out. The student had had enough shame to write half of the essay, and I focused my feedback on improving that part. It's easy to get hung up on stories of academic dishonesty. Late last year, in a survey of college and university leaders, 59% reported an increase in cheating, a figure that feels conservative when you talk to students. AI has returned us to the question of what the point of higher education is. Until we're 18, we go to school because we have to. Studying the Second World War and reducing fractions while undergoing a process of socialization. We're essentially learning how to follow rules. College, however, is a choice, and it has always involved the tacit agreement that students will fulfill a set of tasks, sometimes pertaining to subjects they find pointless or impractical, and then receive some kind of credential. But even for the most mercenary of students, the pursuit of a grade or a diploma has become an ancillary benefit. You're being taught how to do something difficult, and maybe along the way, you come to appreciate the process of learning. But the arrival of AI means that you can now bypass the process and the difficulty altogether. There are no reliable figures for how many American students use AI, just stories about how everyone is doing it. A 2024 Pew Research Center survey of students between the ages of 13 and 17 suggests that a quarter of teens currently use ChatGPT for schoolwork, double the figure from 2023. OpenAI recently released a report claiming that 1 in 3 college students uses its products. There's good reason to believe that these are low estimates. If you grew up Googling everything or using Grammarly to give your prose a professional gloss, it isn't far-fetched to regard AI as just another productivity tool. I see it as no different from Google, Eugene said. I use it for the same kind of purpose. Being a student is about testing boundaries and staying one step ahead of the rules. While administrators and educators have been debating new definitions for cheating and discussing the mechanics of surveillance, students have been embracing the possibilities of AI. A few months after the release of ChatGPT, a Harvard undergraduate got approval to conduct an experiment in which it wrote papers that had been assigned in 7 courses. The AI skated by with a 3.57 GPA, a little below the school's average. Upstart companies introduced products that specialized in humanizing AI-generated writing, and TikTok influencers began coaching their audiences on how to avoid detection. Unable to keep pace, academic administrators largely stopped trying to control students' use of artificial intelligence and adopted an attitude of hopeful resignation, encouraging teachers to explore the practical, pedagogical applications of AI. In certain fields, this wasn't a huge stretch. Studies show that AI is particularly effective in helping non-native speakers acclimate to college-level writing in English. In some STEM classes, using generative AI as a tool is acceptable. Alex and Eugene told me that their accounting professor encouraged them to take advantage of free offers on new AI products available only to undergraduates as companies competed for student loyalty throughout the spring. In May, OpenAI announced ChatGPT EDU, a product specifically marketed for educational use, after schools including Oxford University, Arizona State University, and the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business experimented with incorporating AI into their curricula. This month, the company detailed plans to integrate ChatGPT into every dimension of campus life, with students receiving personalized AI accounts to accompany them throughout their years in college. But for English departments and for college writing in general, the arrival of AI has been more vexed. Why bother teaching writing now? The future of the midterm essay may be a quaint worry compared with larger questions about the ramifications of artificial intelligence, such as its effect on the environment or the automation of jobs. And yet, has there ever been a time in human history when writing was so important to the average person? Emails, texts, social media posts, angry missives in comments sections, customer service chats, let alone one's actual work. The way we write shapes our thinking. We process the world through the composition of text dozens of times a day in what the literary scholar Deborah Brandt calls our era of mass writing. It's possible that the ability to write original and interesting sentences will only become more important in a future where everyone has access to the same AI assistance. Corey Robin, a writer and a professor of political science at Brooklyn College, read the early stories about ChatGPT with skepticism. Then his daughter, a sophomore in high school at the time, used it to produce an essay that was about as good as those his undergraduates wrote after a semester of work. He decided to stop assigning take-home essays. For the first time in his 30 years of teaching, he administered in-class exams. Robin told me he finds many of the steps that universities have taken to combat AI essays to be hand-holding that's not leading people anywhere. He has become a believer in the passage identification Blue Book exam, in which students name and contextualize excerpts of what they've read for class. Know the text and write about it intelligently, he said. That was a way of honoring their autonomy without being a cop. His daughter, who is now a senior, complains that her teachers rarely assign full books, and Robin has noticed that college students are more comfortable with excerpts than with entire articles and prefer short stories to novels. I don't get the sense that they have the kind of literary or cultural mastery that used to be the assumption upon which we assign papers, he said. One study published last year found that 58% of students at two Midwestern universities had so much trouble interpreting the opening passages of Bleak House by Charles Dickens that they would not be able to read the novel on their own, and these were English majors. The return to pen and paper has been a common response to AI among professors, with the sales of Blue Books rising significantly at certain universities in the past 2 years. Sivia Vahendanthan, a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, grew dispirited after some students submitted what he suspected was AI-generated work for an assignment on how the school's honor code should be viewed. AI-generated work. He, too, has decided to return to Blue Books and is pondering the logistics of oral exams. Maybe we go all the way back to 450 BC, he said. But other professors have renewed their emphasis on getting students to see the value of process. Dan Melzer, the director of the first-year composition program on the University of California, Davis, recalled that everyone was in a panic when ChatGPT first hit. Melzer's job is to think about how writing functions across the curriculum so that all students, from prospective scientists to future lawyers, get a chance to hone their prose. Consequently, he has an accommodating view of how norms around curriculum have changed, especially in the internet age. He was sympathetic to kids who viewed some of their assignments as dull and mechanical and turned to ChatGPT to expedite the process. He called the five-paragraph essay the classic hamburger structure, consisting of an introduction, three supporting body paragraphs, and a conclusion, outdated, having transcended from elitist traditions. Melzer believes that some students loathe writing because of how it's been taught, particularly in the past 25 years. The No Child Left Behind Act from 2002 instituted standards-based reforms across all public schools, resulting in generations of students being taught to write according to rigid testing rubrics. As one teacher wrote in the Washington Post in 2013, students excelled when they mastered a form of bad writing. Melzer has designed workshops that treat writing as a deliberative, iterative process involving drafting, feedback from peers, and also from ChatGPT and revision. If you assign a generic essay topic and don't engage in any process, and you just collect it a month later, it's almost like you're creating an environment tailored to crime, he said. You're encouraging crime in your community. I found Meltzer's pedagogical approach inspiring. I instantly felt bad for routinely breaking my class into small groups so that they could workshop their essays as though the meaning of this verb were intuitively clear. But as a student, I'd have found Meltzer's focus on process tedious. It requires a measure of faith that all the work will pay off in the end. Writing is hard, regardless of whether it's a five paragraph essay or a haiku, and it's natural, especially when you're a college student, to want to avoid hard work. This is why classes like Melzer's are compulsory. You can imagine that students really wanted to be there, he joked. College is all about opportunity costs. One way of viewing AI is as an intervention in how people choose to spend their time. In the early 1960s, college students spent an estimated 24 hours a week on schoolwork. Today, that figure is about 15, a sign to critics of contemporary higher education that young people are beneficiaries of grade inflation. In a survey conducted by the Harvard Crimson, nearly 80% of the class of 2024 reported a GPA of 3.7 or higher, and the lack of diligence of their forebears. I don't know how many hours I spent on schoolwork in the late 90s when I was in college, but I recall feeling that there was never enough time. I suspect that, even if today's students spent less time studying, they don't feel significantly less stressed. It's the nature of campus life that everyone assimilates into a culture of busyness, and a lot of that anxiety has been shifted to extracurricular or pre-professional pursuits. A dean at Harvard remarked that students feel compelled to find distinction outside the classroom because they are largely indistinguishable within it. Eddie, a sociology major at Long Beach State, is older than most of his classmates. He graduated high school in 2010 and worked full-time while attending a community college. "I've gone through a lot to be at school," he told me. "I want to learn as much as I can." ChatGPT, which his therapist recommended to him, was ubiquitous at Long Beach even before the California State University system, which Long Beach is a part of, announced a partnership with OpenAI, giving its 460,000 students access to ChatGPT EDU. "I was a little suspicious of how convenient it was," Eddie said. "It seemed to know a lot in a way that seemed so human." He told me that he used AI as a brainstorm, but never for writing itself. "I limit myself for sure." Eddie works for Los Angeles County, and he was talking to me during a break. He admitted that when he was pressed for time, he would sometimes use ChatGPT for quizzes. "I don't know if I'm telling myself a lie," he said. "I've given myself opportunities to do things ethically, but if I'm rushing to work, I don't feel bad about that, particularly for courses outside his major." I recognized Eddie's conflict. I've used ChatGPT a handful of times, and on one occasion, it accomplished a scheduling task so quickly that I began to understand the intoxication of hyper-efficiency. I felt the need to stop myself from indulging in idle queries. Almost all the students I interviewed in the past few months described the same trajectory, from using AI to assist with organizing their thoughts to offloading their thinking altogether. For some, it became something akin to social media, constantly open in the corner of the screen, a portal for distraction. This wasn't like paying someone to write a paper for you. There's no social friction, no aura of illicit activity. Nor did it feel like sharing notes or like passing off what you'd read in Clip Notes or Spark Notes as your own analysis. There was no real time to reflect on questions of originality or honesty. The student basically became a project manager. And for students who use it the way Eddie did, as a kind of sounding board, there's no clear threshold where the work ceases to be an original piece of thinking. In April, Anthropothic, the company behind Claude, released a report drawn from a million anonymized student conversations with its chatbots. It suggested that more than half the user interactions could be classified as collaborative, involving a dialogue between student and AI. Presumably, the rest of the interactions were more extricative. May, a sophomore at Georgetown, was initially resistant to use ChatGPT. "I don't know if it was an ethics thing," she said. "I just thought I could do the assignment better, and it wasn't worth the time being saved." But she began using it to proofread her essays and then to generate cover letters, and now she uses it for pretty much all her classes. "I don't think it's made me a worse writer," she says. "It's perhaps made me a less patient writer. I used to spend hours writing essays, nitpicking over my wording, really thinking about how to phrase things." College made her reflect on her experience in an extremely competitive high school, where she had received top grades but retained very little knowledge. As a result, she was the rare student who found college somewhat relaxed. ChatGPT helped her breeze through busy work and deepen her engagement with the courses she felt passionate about. "I was trying to think, where's all this time going?" she said. "I had never envied a college student until she told me the answer. I sleep more now." Harry Stekopoulos oversees the University of Iowa's English department, which has more than 800 majors. On the first day of his introductory course, he asks his students to write by hand a 200-word analysis of the opening paragraph of Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. There are always a few grumbles, and students have occasionally walked out. I like this, the exercise as a tone setter because it stresses their writing, he told me. The return of Blue Book exams might disadvantage students who were encouraged to master typing at a young age. Once you've grown accustomed to the smooth rhythms of typing, reverting to a pen and paper can feel stifling. But neuroscientists have found that the embodied experience of writing by hand taps into parts of the brain that typing does not. Being able to write one way, even if it's more efficient, doesn't make the other way obsolete. There's something lofty about Stakopoulos's opening day exercise, but there's another reason for it. The handwritten paragraph also begins a paper trail, attesting to voice and style that a teaching assistant can consult if a suspicious paper is submitted. Kevin, a third-year student at Syracuse University, recalled that on the first day of class, the professor had asked everyone to compose some thoughts by hand. That brought a smile to my face, Kevin said. The other kids are scratching their necks and sweating, and I am like, this is kind of nice. Kevin had worked as a teaching assistant for a mandatory course that first-year students take to acclimate to campus life. Writing assignments involve basic questions about students' backgrounds, he told me, but they often used AI anyway. I was very disturbed, he said. He occasionally uses AI to help with translations for his advanced Arabic course, but he's come to look down on those who rely heavily on it. They almost forget that they have the ability to think, he said. Like many former holdouts, Kevin felt that his judicious use of AI was more defensible than his peers' use of it. As ChatGPT begins to sound more human, will we reconsider what it means to sound like ourselves? Kevin and some of his friends pride themselves on having an ear attuned to AI-generated text. The hallmarks, he said, include a preponderance of M dashes, and a voice that feels blandly objective. An acquaintance had run an essay that she had written herself through a detector because she worried that she was starting to phrase things like ChatGPT did. He read her essay. I realized, like, it does kind of sound like ChatGPT. It was freaking me out a bit. A particularly disarming aspect of ChatGPT is that if you point out a mistake, it communicates in the backpedaling tone of a contrite student. Apologies for the earlier confusion. Its mistakes are often referred to as hallucinations, a description that seems to anthropomorphize AI, conjuring a vision of a sleep-deprived assistant. Some professors told me that they had students fact-check ChatGPT's work as a way of discussing the importance of original research and showing the machine's fallibility. Hallucination rates have grown worse for most AIs with no single reason for the increase. As a researcher for the Times, we still don't know how these models work exactly. But many students claim to be unbothered by AI's mistakes. They appear nonchalant about the question of achievement and even disassociate from their work, since it is only not notionally theirs. Joseph, a Division I athlete at a Big Ten school, told me that he saw no issue with using ChatGPT for his classes, but he did make one exception. He wanted to experience his African literature course authentically because it involved his heritage. Alex, the NYU student, said that if one of his AI papers received a subpar grade, his disappointment would be focused on the fact that he'd spent $20 on his subscription. August, a sophomore at Columbia studying computer science, told me about a class where she was required to compose a short lecture on a topic of her choosing. It was a class where everyone was guaranteed an A, so I just put it in and I maybe edited like two words and submitted it, she said. Her professor identified her essay as exemplary work and she was asked to read it from a class of 200 students. I was a little nervous, she said. But then she realized, if they don't like it, it wasn't me who read it, you know? Kevin, by contrast, desired a more general kind of moral distinction. I asked if he would be bothered to receive a lower grade on an essay than a classmate who used ChatGPT. You are listening to The New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Part of me is able to compartmentalize and not be pissed about it, he said. I developed myself as a human. I can have a superiority complex about it. I learned more, he smiled. But then he continued, part of me can also be like, this is so unfair. I would have loved to have hung out with my friends more. What did I gain? I made my life harder for all that time. In all my conversations, just as college students invariably thought of ChatGPT as merely another tool, people older than 40 focused on its effects, drawing a comparison of GPS and the erosion of our relationship to space. The London cab drivers, rigorously trained in the knowledge, famously developed abnormally large posterior hippocampi, the part of the brain crucial for long-term memory and spatial awareness. And yet in the end, most people would probably rather have swifter travel than sharper memories. What is worth preserving, and what do we feel comfortable offloading in the name of efficiency? What if we take seriously the idea that AI assistants can accelerate learning, that students today are arriving at their destinations faster? In 2023, researchers at Harvard introduced a self-paced AI tutor in a popular physics course. Students who used the AI tutor reported higher levels of engagement and motivation and did better on a test than those who learned from a professor. May, the Georgetown student, told me that she often has ChatGPT produce extra practice questions when she's studying for a test. Could AI be here not to destroy education, but to revolutionize it? Barry Lamb teaches in the philosophy department at the University of California, Riverside, and hosts a popular podcast, Hi-Fi Nation, which applies philosophical modes to inquiry to everyday topics. He began wondering what it would mean for AI to actually be a productivity tool. He spoke to me from the podcast studio he built in his shed. Now students are able to generate in 30 seconds what used to take me a week, he said. He compared education to carpentry, one of his many hobbies. Could you skip using power tools without learning to saw by hand? If students were learning things faster, then it stood to reason that Lamb could assign them something very hard. He wanted to test this theory, so for final exams, he gave his undergraduates a PhD level question involving denotive language and the German logician Gottlob Frege, which was frankly beyond me. They fucking failed it miserably, he said. He adjusted his grading curve accordingly. Lamb doesn't find the use of AI morally indefensible. It's not plagiarism in the cut and paste sense, he argued, because there's technically no original version. Rather, he finds it a potential waste of everyone's time. At the start of this semester, he has told students, if you're going to turn in a paper that's ChatGPT generated, then I will grade all your work by ChatGPT and we can all go to the beach. Nobody gets into teaching because he loves grading papers. I talked to one professor who rhapsodized about how much more his students were learning now that he's replaced essays with short exams. I asked if he missed marking up essays. He laughed and said, no comment. An undergraduate at Northeastern University recently accused a professor of using AI to create course materials. She filed a formal complaint with the school, requesting a refund for some of her tuition. The dust-up laid bare the tension between why many people go to college and why professors teach. Students are raised to understand achievement as something discrete and measurable, but when they arrive at college, there are people like me employing them to wrestle with difficulty and abstraction. Worse yet, they are told that grades don't matter as much as they did when they were trying to get into college. Only by this point, students are wired to find the most efficient path possible to good marks. As the craft of writing is degraded by AI, original writing has become a valuable resource for training language models. Earlier this year, a company called Catalyst Research Alliance advertised academic speech debate and student papers from two research studies run in the late 90s and mid-2000s at the University of Michigan. The school asked the company to halt its work. The data was available for free to academics anyway, and a university spokesperson said that student data was not and has never been for sale. But the situation did lead many people to wonder whether institutions would begin viewing the original student work as a potential revenue stream. According to a recent study from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, human intellect has declined since 2012. An assessment of tens of thousands of adults in nearly 30 countries showed an overall decade-long drop in test scores for math and reading comprehension. Andrea Schleicher, the director of education and skills at the OECD, hypothesized that the way we consume information today, often through short social media posts, has something to do with the decline in literacy. One of Europe's top performers in the assessment was Estonia, which recently announced that it will bring AI to some high school students in the next few years, sidelining written essays and rote homework exercises in favor of self-directed learning and oral exams. Lamb, the philosophy professor, used to be a colleague of mine, and for a brief time we were also neighbors. I'd occasionally look out the window and see him building a fence or gardening. He's an avid amateur cook, guitarist, and carpenter, and he remains convinced that there is value to learning how to do things the annoying, old-fashioned, and, as he puts it, artisanal way. He told me that his wife, Shanna Andras, who has been a high school teacher since 2008, frequently disagreed with his cavalier methods for dealing with large learning models. Andras argued that dishonesty has always been an issue. "We are trying to mass educate," she said, measuring there's less room to be precocious about the pedagogical process. "I don't have conversations with students about artisanal writing, but I have conversations with them about our relationship. Respect me enough to give me your authentic voice, even if you don't think it's that great. It's okay. I want you to meet me where you're at." Ultimately, Andras was less fearful of ChatGPT than of the broader condition of being young these days. Her students have grown increasingly introverted, staring at their phones with little desire to practice getting over that awkwardness that defines teen life, as she puts it. AI might contribute to this deterioration, but it isn't solely to blame. "It's a little cherry on top of the already bad ice cream sundae," she said. "When the school year began, my feelings about ChatGPT were somewhere between disappointment and disdain, focused mainly on students. But as the weeks went by, my sense of what should be done and who was at fault grew hazier. Eliminating core requirements, rethinking GPA, and teaching AI skepticism, none of the potential fixes could turn back the preconditions of American youth. Professors can reconceive of the classroom, but there is only so much we can control. I lacked faith that educational institutions would even regard new technologies as anything but inevitable. Colleges and universities, many of which had tried to curb AI used just a few semesters ago, rushed to partner with companies like OpenAI and Anthropic, deeming a product that didn't exist 4 years ago as essential to the future of the school. "Except for a year spent bumming around my hometown, I've basically been on a campus for the past 30 years. Students these days view college as consumers in ways that never would have occurred to me when I was their age. They've grown up at times when society values high-speed takes, not the slow deliberation of critical thinking. Although I've empathized with my students' various mini-dramas, I rarely project myself into their lives. I notice them noticing one another, and I let the mysteries of their lives go. Their pressures are so different from the ones I felt as a student. Although I envy their metabolisms, I would not wish for their sense of horizons. Education, particularly in the humanities, rests on a belief that, alongside the practical things students might retain, some arcane idea mentioned in passing might take root in their mind, blossoming years in the future. AI allows any of us to feel like an expert, but it is risk, doubt, and failure that makes us human. I often tell my students that this is the last time in their lives that someone will have to read something they write so they might as well tell me what they actually think. Despite all the current hysteria around students cheating, they aren't the ones to blame. They did not lobby for the introduction of laptops when they were in elementary school, and it's not their fault that they had to go to school on Zoom during the pandemic. They didn't create the AI tools, nor were they at the forefront of hyping technological innovation. They were just early adopters trying to outwit the system at a time when doing so has never been so easy. And they have no more control than the rest of us. Perhaps they sense this powerlessness even more acutely than I do. One moment, they are being told to learn to code. The next, it turns out employers are looking for the kind of soft skills one might learn as an English or a philosophy major. In February, a labor report from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York reported that computer science majors had a higher unemployment rate than ethnic studies majors did, and that the result some believed of AI automating entry-level coding jobs. None of the students I spoke with seemed lazy or passive. Alex and Eugene, the NYU students, worked hard, but part of their effort went to editing out anything in their college experiences that felt extraneous. They were radically resourceful. When classes were over and students were moving into their summer housing, I emailed with Alex, who was settling in the East Village. He just finished his finals and estimated that he'd spent between 30 minutes and an hour composing two papers for his humanities classes. Without the assistance of Claude, it might have taken him around 8 or 9 hours. "I didn't retain anything," he wrote. "I couldn't tell you the thesis for either paper, ha 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 ha." He received an A- and a B+. Ho Hu is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning memoir, Stay True. He teaches at Bard College. Books. Is technology really ruining teens' lives? In recent years, an irresistibly intuitive hypothesis has both solved and fueled parental anxieties. It's The Phone, by Molly Fisher. In early 2021, the journalist Matt Richel spoke to a father who was a few weeks into a nightmare. Tatne Burnett was a doctor, his wife was a therapist, and until middle school, their daughter, Eleniv, had seemed to be the happy beneficiary of loving parents in a stable home. Then, without apparent external cause, she became depressed and began cutting herself. Her parents sought treatment, including medication and therapy, but on March 1, 2021, Eleniv took an overdose of pills. She arrived at the hospital conscious, then started hallucinating and having seizures before going into cardiac arrest and being placed on life support. She died on March 5th, shortly before her 16th birthday. Later that month, her father tried to make sense of what had happened while talking to a reporter. Richel was at work on what would become The Inner Pandemic, a 2022 series for the New York Times about American teens' mental health, which, by many measures, had been deteriorating for some time. "I could barely hold it together," he writes in his new book, How We Grow Up, Mariner, recalling his harrowing conversations with Burnett. "I was a journalist, yes, but more than that, a father of two children who themselves were on the verge of adolescence." Richel's response was visceral. "I desperately wanted to understand," he writes. In recent years, a seductively intuitive hypothesis to explain stories like Eleniv's has taken shape. It's the phones. A smartphone equipped with TikTok and Instagram contains, in one sleek package, an assortment of forces that might make one teen unhappy. Toxic social dynamics, unrealistic body image, incitement to paralyzing self-consciousness, even a reason to avoid such fundamentals of well-being as a good night's sleep. And parents and professional commentators generally acknowledge phones don't make adults feel so great either. The explanatory power of technology is tantalizing. In Eleniv's case, there was no obvious tech factor, but her parents still grasp after the dominant narratives. "We controlled electronics, monitored friendships," Burnett tells Richel helplessly. The phone consensus is bipartisan, appealing to right-wing moralism and left-wing anti-corporate sentiment alike. States including Florida, Utah, California, and New York have all moved to variously restrict teens' access to social media or if you liked, to restrict social media companies' access to teens. Texas recently came close to passing a bill that would have banned minors from social media altogether. A flock of whistleblowers, journalists, and documentarians have sought both to illuminate the situation and to service parental anxieties. Alarming statistics circulate, along with lists of milestones missed and failures of intellectual and social engagement. Talk to any high school teacher, and anecdotal evidence of a phone-beholden generation abounds. But nailing down the particulars of the problem proves more slippery. Which digital media are bad, under what circumstances, and for whom? According to one oft-cited figure from a 2022 Pew Research report, 46% of teens say that they are online almost constantly, a statement that somehow has the ring of both truth and hyperbole. It's easy to imagine that a lot of teens saying that, and harder to know what they mean. The survey's other possible responses were several times a week or less often, and about once a day and several times a day, all of which suggest a formal and polite level of acquaintance with one's smartphone. In 2023, the Surgeon General released an advisory titled Social Media and Youth Mental Health, which called for more research. Nearly 70% of parents say parenting is now more difficult than it was 20 years ago, with technology and social media as the top two cited reasons, the advisory notes. Yet though it takes the form of statistics, this statement bears only a tenuous relationship to anything quantifiable. For one thing, parents here refer to people with children under the age of 18, a pool with limited firsthand expertise about what it was like to be a parent 20 years ago. In How We Grow Up, Richtel expands his reporting to take in the experience of contemporary adolescents more generally. His hope, he explains, is to answer a pair of broad questions. First, what is the core universal purpose of adolescence? And second, why is adolescence undergoing unprecedented change? What is happening right now? Nowhere in his title does the term online or social media appear, but the image in the book's cover seems to supply a predictable answer to the latter line of inquiry. A big blurry phone clutched in two hands and held aloft, obscuring the face of a teen. The conversation that Richtel's book joins begins in earnest nearly a decade ago with Jean Twenge, a professor of psychology at San Diego State. Twenge was already a generational diagnostician when she set out to analyze young people born between 1995 and 2012. Previously, she'd written a book on millennials born in the 80s and early 90s. Generation Me, published in 2006, promises in its subtitle to assess why today's young Americans are more confident, assertive, entitled, and more miserable than ever before. With iGen, her 2017 bestseller, she offers an account of why today's super-connected kids are growing up less rebellious, more tolerant, less happy, and completely unprepared for adulthood, and what that means for the rest of us. This book supplies a term that achieved no widespread purchase, iGen, and a premise that did, that today's teens have been, in a fundamental and unprecedented way, deformed by technology. Using survey databases and interviews, Twenge documents a decline in well-being that coincides with the growth of smartphone. The group she calls iGen has entered adolescence just as those technologies took hold. Several years later, the New York University social psychologist Jonathan Haidt proposed another name for this cohort, the Anxious Generation. Haidt's book of the same title was published early last year and has not left the Times bestseller list since. Its author, meanwhile, emerged as a leading voice of alarm by picking up where Twenge left off. In The Anxious Generation, Haidt calls her work groundbreaking, but notes that, at the time she was writing, nearly all evidence was correlational. Armed now with ever larger data sets and some experimental findings, he argues that between 2010 and 2015, a generational rewiring took place thanks to two forces. The first was a parental overemphasis on children's safety. The second was the phones. This combination of overprotection in the real world and underprotection in the virtual world brought about a shift from play-based to phone-based childhood, he writes, with young people's mental health as a casualty. Part of hate's appeal to terrified parents is his willingness to provide a stern and confident prescription. No smartphones before high school, no social media before 16, no phones in schools, and more independent child play. His guidance draws on the work of a former journalist named Lenore Skenazy. After winning media notoriety with the 2008 New York Sun column about letting her 9-year-old ride the subway alone, Skenazy reinvented herself as an activist against helicopter parenting and published a book called Free Range Kids. Haight read it when he was a parent of young children and subsequently partnered with Skenazy to help found Let Grow, a nonprofit that advocates for increased childhood independence. He credits her with shaping his thinking, but he's also repackaged her ideas in a way that's enabled them to be taken seriously, where Skenazy offers advice with an air of rambunctious provocation. For a time, she hosted a reality show called World's Worst Mom. Haight projects sober objectivity. His previous book, The Coddling of the American Mind, co-authored with Greg Lukianoff, also addressed generational change and mental health, in that case as manifested in campus conflicts and cancel culture. The author explains in Coddling that they base their argument on a combination of wisdom literatures and cognitive behavioral therapy. Haight adopts a similar formula: classics plus social science and the anxious generation, a book in which quotations from Epictetus and Buddha nestle alongside charts from the CDC. Even as the anxious generation has set the terms for teens and phones discourse, it has attracted critics, some of whom seem primed to react against Haight as a cancel culture warrior. Others, though, have questioned his facts, in particular the data underpinning his argument that phones offer the only reasonable explanation for a stark decline in teen mental health. Haight points to a selection of statistics across Anglophone and Nordic countries to suggest that rising rates of teen unhappiness are an international trend requiring an international explanation. But it's possible to choose other data points that complicate Haight's picture. Among South Korean teens, for example, rates of depression fell between 2006 and 2018. Meanwhile, in the U.S., suicide rates have increased for virtually all age groups in the past 2 decades, not just for teens. Even in the areas in Haight's case appear the strongest, for instance, concerning raising rates of depression among American teenage girls, definite connections are elusive. The science journalist David Wallace Wells has pointed out that the sudden increase in depression among teenage girls coincides not just with the rise of smartphones, but with the shift in screening practices that followed the Affordable Care Act. New guidelines recommended annual depression screenings for teenage girls and mandated that insurers cover them. More girls were saying that they were depressed, yes, but more doctors had started asking. Richtel, entering this debate, stakes out a position between Haight's and those of his skeptics. Rather than questioning the existence of a teen mental health crisis, Richtel seeks to contextualize it. Phones, in his view, aren't a singular explanation, even if they are a legitimate concern. I don't think you need to be an evolutionary biologist or an anthropologist to see the basic logic in this, he writes. Spending 10 hours a day with your face buried in a screen is not good for the developing brain. In a chapter called Social Media, this is the actual science behind the boogeyman. He explains his reluctance to make clear-cut statements on causality. I'm guessing this can feel very unsatisfying, he writes, like really frustrating. Parents and policymakers want answers. I want to provide them. It would be really nice, were it true, to be able to say that the rise in mental health distress is a direct result of heavy use of social media. It's just not that straightforward, though. The only thing worse than no answer is a false one. Like Twen and Haight before him, Richtel proposes a name for today's teens, generation rumination, but he situates their turmoil in a consideration of adolescence as a cultural, sociological, and psychological state that has emerged in recent centuries. The distress teen feels is, he believes, a reasonable response to a world whose challenges are increasingly abstract and intellectual rather than physical. Generation rumination is growing up in the realm of the mind and the psyche, he writes. Asking why some are struggling is like asking why some adolescents of yesteryear skinned their knees and broke their bones while trekking over a mountain to explore new terrain. At the same time, adolescence itself has changed as the age of puberty has fallen. Since the 80s, a growing body of research has found that girls, in particular, are starting puberty much younger than was once considered typical, as early as 6 or 7. Richtel argues that this means young people are now stranded for longer than ever in a state of heightened vulnerability. He describes studies indicating that adolescent brains are particularly drawn to novelty and social information, in addition to the risk-taking and poor judgment for which they've traditionally been known, laying them especially open to the temptations of the phone. Changing environment plus changing puberty equals neurological mismatch, he writes. Richtel intersperses his research with the stories of several teens who help illustrate the broad strokes of his theory. I don't want to blame the internet, but I don't want to blame the internet, one kid who struggled with anxiety and depression tells Richtel. I feel like if I was born in 2000 BC in the Alps, I'd still be depressive, but I think it's wildly exacerbated by the climate we live in. And that's all we have time for today. By Molly Fisher. Molly Fisher has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 2022. She covers books, style, the media, and culture at large. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker magazine. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.